Good afternoon. I'm really glad you're here. We appreciate your presence. Today is the Hugh and Beverly Wommel Lecture sponsored by the Department of Religion and the J.M. Dawson Institute of Church-State Studies at Baylor. We have a great speaker today, and I'm going to introduce him in just a second. Let me just give a couple courtesy ground rules that we use in the Tidwell Building. We would ask that you turn off the cell phones so they don't go off. And also we ask that you respect the time and the place and also respect the investment of our speaker by staying until the end of the lecture. I think that's going to be somewhere around 4:30. As our practice is in Miller Chapel at the conclusion of the lecture, we'll probably give about 60 seconds and I'll key that if you have to leave. But then we hope that there will be a few moments with our guest speaker to have some questions and answers. And I think this speech will make you want to be here for that. Our guest speaker this year is Dr. Marvin McNichol. He is currently the president, professor of church leadership, and director of the program of Black Church Studies at Colgate Rochester Crozier Divinity School in Rochester, New York. That's a pretty amazing background. A native of Chicago, Illinois, 1970 graduate of Aurora University in Aurora, Illinois. Also went to seminary at Union Theological Seminary in New York, then received a Doctor of Ministry degree at Princeton Theological Seminary in New Jersey, and then a Doctor of Philosophy degree from Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. In addition to that educational background, he has 34 years of experience in pastoral ministry. He was ordained at the historic Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem in New York City. He's also been involved, that's one of the reasons why we asked him to come this year. He's been involved extensively in politics, in the relationship between religious faith and the government and politics. He has served as the as the chair of the NAACP in two different cities where he has lived. He has received numerous honors in addition to now being the 12th president of Colgate Rochester. He's written 14 different books. The one that I read that made me want to have Dr. McNichol here is entitled Pulpit and Politics: Separation of Church and State and the Black Church. We have a couple of these books up front if you'd like to look at them at the conclusion of the lecture. He has written for the Academy and also the Church, for example, Be My Witness, the Great Commission for Preachers. Really looking forward to the Wommel Lecture this year with Dr. McNichol, and I'm now going to turn it over to him.
Thank you so much, first of all, for the introduction. Grateful to you for that, and also for the invitation to come and be a part of this lecture series. I acknowledge the benefactors, G. Hugh and Beverly C. Wommel, who've established this lectureship, and am really grateful to be added to the number of persons who've been invited to share as a part of its legacy. Special words of thanks to those who provided a variety of kinds of hospitality while I have been here. Pickups from the airport, trips back and forth to and from the hotel, a wonderful luncheon that was held this afternoon with some members of the department's faculty, and now for the chance to share. So I'm really grateful to all of you for your kindnesses and for your warm welcome, and look forward to sharing with you even after the lecture is over. As was hinted at, this is about a 1 hour formal presentation, and then at the end of that, to the extent that there is time and interest for some additional questions, I'd be more than happy to stay for as long as it takes. But I understand that at an undergraduate level, maybe there are other things that beckon for your attention, so certainly at 4:30, do as the spirit leads. We'll leave it with that. With the 2016 presidential election only 1 month away, and with various religious leaders from across the country, serving as surrogates and supporters of at least the two major party candidates, with discussions about religious liberty coming into the news on an almost daily basis. It seems to me that now is a good time for a discussion about the intersection between religion and politics. I arrived in Waco just yesterday, picked up a copy of the local newspaper, turned, as is my custom, first of all, to the editorial page, and saw there an editorial written by a member of the Baylor faculty entitled, "Is Christianity Averting Its Eyes This Election?" One cannot escape the fact that matters of religion and politics are in the news. Paula White, well-known prosperity preacher from here in Texas, was a speaker at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. The Reverend William Barber, African-American clergy, president of the North Carolina chapter of the NAACP, was a speaker at the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia. Two of my former Cleveland, Ohio colleagues have spoken up during this cycle, the Reverend Beryl Scott, whom I have known for 25 or 30 years, has become one of the chief clergy liaisons for the Donald Trump campaign. My other Cleveland colleague, the Reverend Otis Moss, has written a fairly lengthy letter expressing his support for Hillary Clinton. So the question of religion and politics certainly is present in terms of those religious leaders who have spoken on behalf of one or the other of the major party candidates. However, the question of the intersection between religion and politics should not be and cannot be limited to which preachers are supporting which candidates. There are instead some major policy issues at stake, which also force a discussion about this intersection between religion and politics. There has been, for instance, talk of banning Muslims from the country, of engaging in surveillance of Muslim mosques. CNN ran a series called Islamerica, Islamerica, the catchy fusion of the words Islam and America. In one of those reports, reference was made to a 17-year-old girl whose name was Alina Khan. She was writing a research paper for her class, high school class. The topic was, what do people in America think about Muslims? Some basic research led her to the two following quotes. First quote, "Hard to tell what we should build first, a border wall or a gas chamber for Muslims." Second quote, "The only peaceful and moderate Muslims are the dead ones." This sort of intolerant and nativist speech is, for me, reminiscent of the ways in which both Native Americans and, more precisely, African Americans were discussed in the 19th and 20th centuries. The rumor has persisted for more than 6 years that the President of the United States is a Muslim, born outside of the United States, perhaps in Kenya. And one of the major party candidates helped to sustain that so-called birther movement for all of that time. An effort which was, in my view, and not mine alone, nothing less than an orchestrated attempt to delegitimize the nation's first African-American president by portraying him as something other than the mainstream American. So after more than 6 years of pursuing this argument, in the 37-second announcement, we were told that, in fact, Barack Obama is an American citizen. Of course, Article 6, Section 3 of the U.S. Constitution expressly forbids and prohibits any religious test for any person seeking any elected or appointed office in this country, thus making the president's alleged religious affiliation a non-issue. But even that, along with a birth certificate, seemed not to be enough to satisfy those whose skepticism remains to this day. Nor does the data. There are over 3 million Muslims living in this country. Since September 11th, 2001, 344 of them were involved in some act of terrorism. That means that law-abiding Muslims living in this country outnumber those who committed a terrorist act by a ratio of 10,000 to 1. Yet, those 344 have caused some political candidates and their supporters to desire policies and to engender attitudes that would impact all 3 million Muslim Americans. This proves the fact stated by the German poet Gerhard Goethe in 1826, that nothing is more frightful than ignorance in action. The intersection of religion and politics seems to pop up every week with fresh and sometimes frightening examples. On September the 29th of this year, a federal judge, Roy Moore from Alabama, was suspended from office until he reaches retirement age in 2019 because he instructed probate court judges in that state to defy federal law regarding same-sex marriage ceremonies. He gave those directives because higher court rulings that authorized the performance of such ceremonies, in a quotation taken from USA Today, did not square with his personal theological beliefs. This is not to debate his beliefs. It is to simply state the degree to which issues of religion and politics are thrust upon us on an ongoing basis. Privately owned companies like Hobby Lobby have been granted an exemption by the U.S. Supreme Court from having to comply with portions of the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. The owners of that company do not want to be required to offer insurance coverage to their employees that would include birth control options, a practice that the owners of the company oppose on religious grounds. The state of Indiana introduced a freedom of religion law that would have allowed private business to deny professional services to same-sex couples citing their religious convictions as the basis for their actions. Mike Pence, who is now the Republican vice presidential nominee, signed that bill into law in 2015. Only after threatened boycotts by the NBA, the NCAA, and other major corporations was that law not rescinded, but amended. But the possibility of discrimination based upon sexual identity continues. It is time for discussion of the intersection between religion and politics. A conservative group known as the American Association of Evangelicals, not to be confused with the National Association of Evangelicals, writing in an online journal called Christian Today, not to be confused with the well-known journal Christianity Today, declares that progressive evangelicals and Catholics need to repent because their focus on social justice, immigration reform, and the environment are turning our nation over to the enemies of biblical faith, end quote. This open letter begs for an exegetical analysis of the writings of those conservative persons, like Wayne Grudem, one of the signatories, over against the language of Matthew 25, 31 to 44, with rather explicit references to the fact that entrance into God's presence is tied to one's response to the hungry, the thirsty, the sick, the imprisoned, and especially the strangers living among us. It should not go unspoken, by the way, that Wayne Grudem wrote another open letter to the Christians in which he stated, and I quote, "Voting for Donald Trump is a morally good choice." This endorsement of a political candidate comes only after Grudem observed the following. He is egotistical, bombastic, and brash. He insults people. He can be vindictive when people attack him. He had been married 3 times and claims to have been unfaithful in all of his marriages. These are, said Grudem, flaws. But I don't think they are disqualifying flaws in this election. Of course, that letter predates more recently released activities of the candidate that one can hardly even speak about in public. I raise this issue not to challenge Grudem's right to his opinion or anyone else's, but just to point out how strange it is to hear these words coming from a self-declared religious conservative, pointing again to the need to have a conversation about the intersection between religion and politics. Grudem was among 900 conservative Christian leaders who met with this candidate in New York City, and he gave them strong assurances about their religious values. Here is the chief of his assurances. "I will work as hard as I can to put Christ back into Christmas." Hardly. According to those who were quoted in the news about this event, no one asked him to explain his shift from being a supporter of partial birth abortion to now being an advocate of punishment for women who have abortions. This led Michael Gerson of the Washington Post to conclude that genuine social influence on the part of Christians will not come by putting Christ back into Christmas. It will come by putting Christ and Christ's priorities back into more Christians. Consider a recent editorial, again from the Washington Post, E.J. Dionne, in which he bemoans the fact that the voices of established religious leaders are so rarely heard during this campaign cycle. He then states, "When we do talk about religious issues, we are not talking about the nature of God, or how to contemplate the Exodus, or the meaning of the resurrection. Instead," he quotes, "we go straight to the hot button issues of abortion and gay marriage." Thus, he says, religion is talked about a lot, but not at the level of theology. That is just what happened at the so-called Trump summit with conservative leaders. "What is missing," says E.J. Dionne, "are," and I quote, "religious intellectuals, thinkers who are taken seriously by believers and non-believers alike." He then quotes another person from Baylor, Alan Jacobs, who observes that religious intellectuals are the missing solvent in our fractious culture wars. Jacobs goes on to raise the question, "Where is our Reinhold Niebuhr?" Referring to the 20th century theologian who served in this role of public religious intellectual for nearly 40 years. But I press on, because the intersection of religion and politics is not and should not be discussed as if the problem was only one within the confines of this country. This is, in fact, a global problem in demand of a global response. ISIS and Boko Haram are slaughtering people in Nigeria, Syria, and Afghanistan because they will not convert to Islam or live according to the most extreme forms of Islamic law. The long-term goal of ISIS, or ISIL, is the creation of an Islamic caliphate that roughly matches the concept of the Ottoman Empire where the lines between religion and politics cease to exist altogether. Look at the genocide being directed against the Yazidis, a small religious minority in Iraq, that has been targeted not for persecution, but for extinction by the Islamic State. One can already see the notion of what a religious state might look like in the Middle East by looking at Iran, where every action of the president of the country must ultimately be approved or ratified or completely set aside by its supreme leader, who is Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who succeeded Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, who launched the Iranian Revolution in 1979 that overthrew the regime of the Shah. While the president of Iran stands for election, the supreme leader serves a lifetime appointment, which in his case began in 1989. Consider as well the very recent tensions over the Kashmir territory between India and Pakistan that resulted in the death of 18 Indian soldiers with another 24 wounded, attacks that the Indian government blames on Islamic terrorists. The reason that these two nuclear powers face off across a heavily militarized border dividing them is because of a 70-year-long dispute about whether followers of Islam or Hinduism should have constituted the majority of their government after India gained independence from Great Britain in 1947-1948. More importantly, more subtly, on a global scale, look at the enormous financial support that Vladimir Putin of Russia is providing to the worldwide Orthodox Church, and especially to the Greek monastery of Athos, which is viewed by Orthodox Christians as the holiest place on earth. Putin is using Orthodox Christianity, not the slogans of Marxism and Leninism, to build a coalition of support from other Orthodox countries in Europe, like Belarus, Ukraine, Romania, Bulgaria, Moldova, Cyprus, and Greece itself. There are 566 million Christians in Europe. Of that number, 262 million are Roman Catholic. 200 million are Orthodox Christians. Here is an altogether different approach to the issues of religion and politics that could, in a very short time, alter the geopolitical landscape, at least of Eastern Europe. It seems that one of the measurements for who can and cannot be a legitimate presidential candidate in this 2016 cycle is a willingness to speak the words, radical Islamic terrorism. Will you or will you not say the words, radical Islamic terrorism? Now, there is no doubt that egregious acts of terror have been committed in this country and in countries all over the world by persons who claim some allegiance to Islam. That cannot be refuted. That being said, there are two dangers attached to the easy use of the term radical Islamic terrorism. The first is the all too easy tendency to paint the worldwide 1 billion plus adherents of Islam with a single brush, as if Islam and radical Islamic terrorism are synonyms. If that were true, then one could also say that all white Christians in this country are racists and white supremacists due to the burning of a cross at a KKK rally, followed by their sworn allegiance to Christian values. Those in this country who would consider such a claim to be offensive and even outrageous should then consider the idea of thinking that radical Islamic terrorism and Islam are the same thing. But there's a second and perhaps even more serious problem. It serves to disconnect the actions of 21st century terrorism from the decades and even centuries-long colonial rule on the part of European powers in the Middle East, most especially Britain and France. Those two nations, for hundreds of years, employed unspeakable acts of force and brutality and even terrorism to maintain their colonial empires in Africa, Asia, the Middle East, and the Caribbean. Many in this country were ready to place tight restrictions on Muslim immigration and upon Muslims already in this country after 9/11, 2001, because the terrorists involved in those horrific attacks were Muslims. A bill was recently passed over a presidential veto that now allows individuals who are impacted by those attacks to sue the government of Saudi Arabia. This new law now allows every American overseas and our own government and every multinational corporation to itself become the target of the foreign governments where they are present. It is a quid pro quo. It is this versus that. We can sue them, they can now sue us. What is more important and what goes unnoticed and unacknowledged is how U.S. foreign policy over several decades contributed to those very terrorist acts. No thought is given to the way in which the CIA conspired to force a regime change in Iran in 1953 that put the Shah of Iran on the throne after the people of Iran had worked to remove him. That was the event that fueled the Iranian hostage crisis of 1979 and beyond. They overlook or never knew or don't care about how this country worked with and equipped and funded a group called the Mujahideen, an organization headed by Osama bin Laden to fight against the Russians in Afghanistan. They blame the conflicts in Iraq today on how we pulled our army out in 2013, rather than on the false claims of weapons of mass destruction that were never found, or worse, the way the nation of Iraq was created in 1922. Iraq, which emerged out of the Ottoman Empire, which collapsed after World War I, was created in a drawing room in London in 1922 by two diplomats who drew some lines on a map and said which parts would go to them and which parts would go to others, ignoring all of the religious, tribal, and cultural differences within the lines they were drawing, and did this without any consultation with the neighboring countries who could have told them that what we now see is what was predictable. Whatever Islamic terrorism is, and whoever they are, it is impossible to respond to their present actions without first understanding their underlying grievances. There is a parallel. Many white people in this country do not know what to make of Black Lives Matter. Some even call it race riots in our streets. Whatever you think about Black Lives Matter, you ought not judge it based upon the actions you see today without giving some thought to the basis of the underlying grievances rooted in a practice of excessive force by both law enforcement officials and organized hate groups, at least for the last 150 years of this nation's history. What all of these issues clearly point to is the importance and the urgency of a broad and comprehensive discussion on the intersection of religion and politics, not only in this country, but in places all over the world, and in this country, mindful of what's going on in places all over the world. question then is, where should such a discussion begin? More precisely, to whom should we look to guide us and inform us and enlighten us about all that is at stake in our world today at this intersection? For some people, a discussion about religion and politics always seems to begin with a discussion about the separation of church and state as a cardinal virtue within the U.S. context of political activity. Most people do not know that the phrase separation of church and state is not even in the U.S. Constitution. In fact, that term appears nowhere in the document. It is attributable to Thomas Jefferson in a letter he wrote to Baptists in Danbury, Connecticut in 1802. And in that letter, Jefferson was not trying to prevent religious groups from being politically active. Instead, he was warning against the government becoming engaged in the life and teachings of those religious groups. Before Jefferson, of course, the term has its rootage in the language of Roger Williams in England in 1644, in the Bloody Tenet, in which he says, giving any power to the magistrate over the church meant giving power to the people over the church. If no religion but that which the Commonwealth approves, then there is no Christ, no God, but at the pleasure of the world. In both cases, Jefferson and Williams, the issue was not how to keep religion out of politics, but how to keep the government out of the inner workings of religious organizations. More about which I will say in a moment. So we turn to the actual language of the First Amendment in the Constitution, which has two distinct views on the topic of church and state. The relevant wording of that amendment says, Congress shall make no laws respecting, one, the establishment of religion, and two, or the free exercise thereof. I repeat, the First Amendment says in part, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or the free exercise thereof. What the First Amendment provides is a safeguard against the establishment either of a preferred religious tradition that is aided and supported by the state or the federal government, that can sometimes deny voting rights to citizens that do not belong to the established church, or that requires persons to pay taxes that support a particular religious tradition, whether or not those citizens adhere to that religious practice. The so-called Establishment Clause prevents the formation of a state-sanctioned religion that is supported by the government, as well as the existence of a government whose leadership is limited only to those who are members of that state-supported church. The Free Exercise Clause expressly allows persons to embrace whatever religious practices they might choose, including no religious practice at all. The language of the First Amendment is why Stephen Prothero, writing in his book Religious Literacy, could say, thanks to the Establishment Clause, the American government is secular by law. Thanks to the Free Exercise Clause, American society is religious by choice. I repeat. Thanks to the Establishment Clause, Congress shall pass no law regarding the establishment of religion. American government is secular by law. Thanks to the Free Exercise Clause, American society is religious by choice. Prior to the First Amendment, this country had embraced, based upon the European model, the practice of state-sanctioned churches that they brought with them from Europe, with all the restrictions and all the limitations attached. 1783, New Jersey, Delaware, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, and Vermont prohibited Jews or Catholics from serving in their state legislatures. Pennsylvania and Maryland barred Jews, but not Catholics. In Massachusetts, Jews continued to be excluded, and the only way a Catholic could hold any elected office in that state was if they first renounced the authority of the Pope. Needless to say, Native Americans and people of African ancestry were not a part of this discussion. In all 13 colonies, and following that in the United States as its own new nation, they were completely disenfranchised and not to be considered. The U.S. Constitution did have one provision, which was called the Three-Fifths Clause. Three-Fifths Clause said that for purposes of taxation and congressional representation, you could count all the people held in bondage, each one as three-fifths of a person, so that three-fifths of a person could be counted for taxes and for census. Black people in 1783 were not considered whole persons, just three-fifths, and that not for individual rights, but only for the benefit of taxation and representation of their white slave owners. And Indians, Native Americans, were not to be counted at all. In other words, white males were fighting a war against Great Britain and its oppressive hand, debating among themselves the notion of religious liberty, and at the same time were content to deny human rights, never mind religious liberty, liberty to Native Americans, African Americans, and women of all ethnic groups, including their own. The singular fixation on the First Amendment, on religious liberty, on soul freedom, serves to mask one very important point about which church in this country should have never been silent. You cannot, in the same nation, talk about the right for the freedom of conscience, but at the same time, you are actively involved in the transatlantic slave trade. It would take the 13th Amendment, 1865, the 14th Amendment, 1868, and the 15th Amendment, 1870, to finally include people of African ancestry, the men, the males, to the body politic. Rights which by 20 years removed by force of terrorism by the Ku Klux Klan and other hate groups would be revoked. It would take the 19th Amendment in 1920 to give women the right to vote. It would take the Indian Citizenship Act of 1924 to declare that Native Americans were also citizens of the United States. However, universal voting rights for Native Americans was not guaranteed in this country until the Voting Rights Act of 1965. An act which most people think only involved voting rights for African Americans. Perhaps that was the time of political disenfranchisement, when Indians, Native Americans, African Americans, and women could not vote. Perhaps that is the time that some people have in mind when they want to make America great again. The truth is, however, that the discussion about religious liberty can't be dated to the 17th or 18th century in this country. It must go back at least as far as the conflicts in Europe, all driven by issues of religion and politics. In 1384, John Wycliffe was burned at the stake for defying the Roman Catholic Church and translating the Bible into English. John Huss was similarly executed in 1415 for supporting what Wycliffe had done. The Spanish Inquisition that began in Spain and Portugal in the 15th century saw the power of a state-sanctioned Roman Catholic Church arrest, torture, execute, or demand forced conversions of Jews and Muslims. One of my favorite preachers, the Italian preacher Girolamo Savonarola, was in 1498 burned at the stake for failing to conform to Orthodox Roman Catholic teaching. William Tyndale was first strangled and then burned alive in England in 1536 for translating the Bible into English without the permission of King Henry VIII. Of course, by 1534, King Henry VIII had severed ties with the Roman Catholic Church because the Pope would not sanction the annulment of his marriage from Catherine of Aragon, to whom he had been married for 16 years, but failed to provide him with a male heir. And of course, central to all of this were the words and deeds of Martin Luther, who directly challenged the authority of the Pope with the notions that authority is not in the person of the Pope, sola scriptura and sola fide. The impact of the Reformation on the issues of religion and politics was swift and long-lasting. The battle in 1588 between Spain and England, when the mighty Spanish Armada was defeated in the English Channel, was part of a larger religious war between Protestants and Catholics. King Philip of Spain wanted to reimpose Catholicism in England, and Queen Elizabeth I was determined to maintain the Church of England begun by her father. So Queen Elizabeth said, there cannot be two religions in the same state. There cannot be two religions in the same state. That two-nation conflict eventually spilled over into what subsequently became known as the 30 Years' War between 1618 and 1648, which remains to this day as the longest war in European history. John Barry wrote about that war by saying, and I quote, "Christians killed other Christians because of how each of them worshiped Christ." England made some concessions with the Act of Toleration of 1689 that allowed some freedom of worship to those who dissented from the form of the Church of England. All they had to do to be exempted was to just swear ultimate allegiance to the English monarch. However, even in the Act of Toleration, Jews, Catholics, and Unitarians were not included. Thus, there was no such thing as religious liberty or freedom of conscience or separation of church and state anywhere in Europe for a period of more than 400 years. There was only the will of the monarch or the power of the state used to fund and support state-sanctioned religion. Now, I want to suggest that there is a need to push the discussion about the intersection of religion and politics back to an even earlier age. It cannot start in 18th century America or 16th century Europe. I would suggest, particularly on the campus of Baylor University and in the presence of those who may have some value for biblical faith and teachings, that you ought to push it at least as far back as the encounters of religious and political leaders as recorded in various portions of Scripture. Listen to the discussions, listen to the arguments, listen to the issues at stake as Moses confronts Pharaoh, as Nathan confronts David, as Amos challenges both Amaziah and Jeroboam, as Ezekiel challenges Ahab and Jezebel. These are intersections of the power of the state authority of a religious leader. None of those prophets, not Moses, not Nathan, not David, not Nathan, not Amos, not Ezekiel, none of them was interested in pursuing an argument about the forms of religious practice. They were not debating who could or could not take communion, who could or could not be ordained, or what earthly political or clerical ruler had the ultimate authority. That was not what they were pushing for. They were insistent that religious practice was not a substitute for justice and righteousness. They reminded their nation and their political leaders, and they still remind nations and political leaders, that what God demands is not sacrifice, but obedience. Not liturgies, but love for one another. Not membership in the appropriate religious organizations, but care and concern for the widows, the orphans, the strangers among us. It could be argued that global history would have been entirely different if people of faith had managed to tear themselves away from the narrow definition of the intersection between religion and politics as fueled by the terms of religious liberty and conscience as regards the practice of religion, and embrace instead the examples and images of 8th, 7th, and 6th century BC prophets of Israel. Now, we have seen glimpses of what this could look like, a prophetic witness in the face of political pressure. It could be seen among the Quakers in this country in their early and risky opposition to slavery because they viewed it as against the will of God and ran great personal risks to help runaway slaves escape through the Underground Railroad and were considered as disloyal to the country. We saw it with Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Karl Barth, and other German clergy during the Nazi era between 1933 and 1945. We saw it in the Bormann Declaration that declared their opposition to most of what Hitler was doing long before the rest of the world realized what Hitler was doing. Beginning with an attempt to subvert the church in Germany and turn it into an instrument of his own political power. Hence you had both the German church controlled by the Nazis, and the church in Germany, controlled by Jesus Christ. We saw it among white pastors in southern states during the Civil Rights Movement in the 1950s and 60s, who against the will of many of their members and denominational leaders, stood up and spoke out against racism, against segregation, and most especially against the unimaginable violence being directed toward black churches and black clergy by white Christians and cross-burning members of the KKK who continually pledged their support to Jesus. Many of those white clergy lost their jobs. I know three or four of them personally who ran the risk and paid the price. We saw this intersection of religion and politics in 1966 with Martin Luther King Jr., who broke with Lyndon Baines Johnson and openly spoke against the war in Vietnam. It may well be that it was his opposition to U.S. foreign policy, far more than his views on race relations, that cost Martin King's life. And we see it today with William Barber and Moral Monday protests in North Carolina aimed at overturning harsh voter suppression efforts in that state. Now, what have we seen or heard so far in the 2016 political cycle? that even vaguely resembles a church, that is informed and influenced by the prophetic side of its identity. I'm not interested in offering personal critiques of the leaders of either major party. I'm not here to advocate for or against either one or the other two third party or fourth party candidates. This is not an attempt to offer a partisan political analysis. I want to ask a different church, a different question. Where is the church? What have we heard from the church about building a wall or enforcing a ban to keep people out of the country? What have we heard from the church about Black Lives Matter? What have we heard from the church about a political campaign in which neither presidential candidate has said a single word about the root causes of poverty, about mass incarceration of persons of color, about the continuing wealth gap between the richest and the poorest in society, or, subtly, the resegregation of American cities and schools? What have we heard from the church? I don't fault Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton if this is not their language. This is not their language. This is our language. And right now, that voice is not speaking. The question for the church is not who are you voting for. The question is, what is your ultimate allegiance? The question is what the church is saying to our political leaders, not what they're trying to say to us. The question is, have we embraced the prophetic side of our identity? Now, I understand that prophetic ministry can be risky business. It can be followed by certain expected consequences. The risks that prophetic speech incurs calls to mind the words of Reinhold Niebuhr, who said in 1924, "I am not surprised that most of the prophets were itinerant. They were not around for next Sunday, for the congregational meeting that might result in their being denounced or disciplined or even dismissed." In that same book, Niebuhr spoke again, Leaves the Notebook of a Tame Cynic. He spoke again about prophetic preaching when he said, "Most budding prophets are tamed and become harmless parish priests." Ponder with me that vision. Someone who approaches the world fresh from their instruction about the lessons of Amos and Jeremiah and Jesus and John and Paul. Budding prophets, prepared to say, "Let justice roll down like water and righteousness like a mighty stream," and over time, they become harmless parish priests with no focus on anything that does not involve their congregation, their building, their ministry. I conclude by offering two quotes from Cornel West. One from his book, Democracy Matters, the other from his writing, Black Prophetic Fire. In Democracy Matters, Cornel West says, and this is a quote, it's rather long, and I invite you to notice his reference not to prophetic preachers, but to prophetic beings. In other words, the ministry that he's looking for does not reside in the pulpit, it sits in the pew. Prophetic beings have as their special aim, here's two phrases, to shatter deliberate ignorance and willful blindness to the sufferings of others, and to expose the clever forms of evasion and escape that we devise in order to hide and conceal injustice. Now, these are two phrases, two different tasks. deliberate ignorance. I don't want to know. Willful blindness. I don't want to see. It is not that some things cannot be known. It is not that some things cannot be seen. I don't want to know. I don't want to see. Which reminds me of the story of the little boy who was once asked the question, which is worse, ignorance or apathy? And the answer was, I don't know and I don't care. He goes on, prophetic ministry, and then it has three steps. Prophetic ministry stirs up within us the courage to care. Nothing changes. Nothing happens. If the majority of people in the country don't have the courage to care, they see it, they know it, they are indifferent to it. I get a lot of my inspiration from the comic strips. One of them is a Sunday morning version of Garfield the Cat. I invite you to study the theology of Garfield because he is a real window into American values. So Garfield the Cat is sitting at a table on Thanksgiving, having Thanksgiving meal. Garfield. Turkey, wine, or gobbies or something or other, bread, vegetables, and the aroma, you can see it wafting up in the air. He's having Thanksgiving by himself. That's the first panel. In the next panel, you see Odie the dog outside, chained to a post with an empty food bowl and an empty water bowl. Third panel, it's Odie outside and Garfield inside. So you can see them sort of side by side. The fourth panel, this is Sunday, six panels on Sunday. The fourth panel is Garfield getting up to walk to the window. And you think he's getting ready to open the window and do one of two things. Either hand Odie a drumstick or better yet, invite it in out of the cold. The fifth panel, Garfield closes the draperies so as not to see Odie. And in the sixth panel, he's back at his table saying to himself, that's better. Deliberate ignorance, willful blindness, and incapacity to care. Says West, we must first of all have the courage to care and empower ourselves to change our lives first and then our historical circumstances. The next quote from West, as I press it here, from the book Black Prophetic Fire, is the use of a Greek term. Not a Koine Greek term, but a classical Greek term called parhesia, P-A-R-R-H-E-S-I-A, parhesia. Which he lists from the speech that Socrates gave in Athens just before he drank the hemlock. West translates parhesia to mean bold speech uttered without regard for the speaker's safety or security. Thus Socrates tells the men of Athens that this is the truth and the whole truth. I have dissembled nothing. This plainness of speech makes them hate me, and what is their hatred but proof that I am speaking the parhesia? In my last book, which is entitled Be My Witness, I point to the words of Jesus to his disciples in Acts 1, 6 through 8, where he instructs them to be his witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. So half of the charge is location. Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, the end of the earth. Sovereignty. But the other half of the challenge is a matter of what to do when you get to Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and the end of the earth. Be my witness. I then take the word witness into three directions. One is a witness is someone who sees something. Pays attention, observes, takes note of. Jesus wants us to see what is going on in the world. Secondly, Jesus wants us to use a courtroom analogy Do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? A witness in a courtroom swears to tell the truth. Will you tell the truth? But the third is rooted in the Greek word martyria. Jesus says, be my martyria, which is the basis for the English word martyr. When viewed through the lens of this third definition, Jesus is inviting his disciples to keep their eyes open to what can be seen of injustice around them, have the courage to speak about it, even if you know it may have consequences upon you and your ministry. This is the work of a prophet, standing at the intersection of religion and politics, both in this country and around the world, to see the wrongs at work, to say something truthful about what you have seen, and to be prepared to be undeterred by the prospect that you might suffer something, some loss, some insult, some something, because you had the courage to speak, because you found your parhesia. To those of our generation who are enamored of prosperity theology and who are not likely to be emboldened enough for prophetic speech, I offer this final word. What good is it for someone who gains the whole world and forfeits their soul? Thank you.
Dr. McMichael for sharing with us this compelling address. We're going to have a little bit of time for Q&A. I hope you'll stay. If you're not going to stay, I'm going to give you about 60 seconds to leave. So, thank you. I want to thank the rest of you for staying and like to open it up to Q&A. My role is going to be, if you raise your hand, I'm going to point to you. But please, one at a time, please address your questions to Dr. McMichael. We have a first question, anybody? Malcolm.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. McMichael, for your talk. My question is, so when thinking of that person in Acts, when Christ tells his disciples, to what extent does it matter that these are individuals who have witnessed the crucified and resurrected Christ? How does that shape the way in which, and this, as we think of the call to us to be prophetic in the situations where the Lord has placed us? To what extent does the crucified and resurrected Christ matter for the way that we view and act in those?
Well, of course, there are two ways to come at that. One way is from Paul, who was forever being challenged in his authority to speak on par with the other 11, because he had not had that sort of walking with Jesus experience. And it took him a while to convince, I'm sure, Peter and a few others. But the Damascus Road is a significant event, and don't count me out. But Jesus himself says, blessed are those, this is to Thomas, blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe. Now, I will grant you that there is enormous influencing power in observing something with your own eyes. But the fact of the matter is that the church over the centuries, over the millennia, has been established. People have gone all over the world in the promise of the scriptures, in the power of the scriptures, and in the faith that he who is revealed therein is who they risk their entire lives to say he is. So I think there's great benefit in having experienced something. I'm old enough to have experienced the civil rights movement. I was old enough to be on these marches. Andrew asked me if I actually knew Martin Luther King Jr., and I actually did, and was actually in jail with Ralph Abernathy on a few occasions. So, you know, sure, it is good if you can say what you saw. It is better if you can stand on the shoulders of those who saw it, embrace the vision that they had, and then take revelation very seriously. All of them died in faith, not having seen the promise, but believing that it was true, that it was there, and they gave themselves to it. I think that's where all of us are, who are sort of, you know, way post-resurrection, you know. Here's another issue. So one of my preaching models was Cardinal Taylor, now deceased, just a glorious preacher. And before he died, he wrote an essay that was printed in the African American Pulpit, a journal that's now along being published, in which he raised the question, is our preaching still Christian? And at the basis of his argument was, increasingly there are preachers who are becoming binary. There's a lot of reference to God. There's a lot of reference to the Holy Spirit. There's a hush about the name of Jesus. And if you listen to a lot of contemporary music, what you're going to hear is a lot of references to God and a lot of references to the power and maybe an occasional reference to him, but not much about Jesus. And his point is, if you take Jesus out of the transaction and you don't have the death, the burial, the resurrection, the commissioning of Acts 1, the active involvement of the disciples under that power going forward, you don't really have a Christian church as the world experienced it. So I think we have to, in this multi-faith, increasingly secular world, cling to that name. There is power in that name. And to lose it is to lose our way.
Thanks, sir.
Another question. Sir, Dr. McMillan, probably because I am one, but I hope that we need some tame priests in our lives. And I mean, I help myself sleep at night by saying that people can better hear the truth if they know that I love them. Mm-hmm. And so there's a struggle there, a tension in which we live. Those of us who are living in churches, mm-hmm. About how it seems to me too easy to proclaim or claim the prophet's mantle and get kicked out of the community and just go to the next one. Mm-hmm. I think the hard part is telling the truth with people you have to live with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which I did for 34 years.
Right.
So believe me, I understand the challenge. So let's go back to the verse and sort of dissect it. So I'm arguing in this book that he doesn't just say, be my witness, but he gives you specific places in which to do that. First one is your particular Jerusalem. This is your church. This is your local community. This is where you live. This is where your children go to school. So pay attention to the issues that are not just happening inside your church, but within your local community. Issues of public education, issues of environmental hazards. What's going on where you are? Pay attention. Be a witness to that. The second one is very intentional. This was a Roman-occupied culture and country. What does Jesus have to say to an occupied people? How do you live under these conditions? There's a professor of Old Testament who's at the Proctor School in Richmond who talks about the fact that it's hard to read the Bible accurately if you don't read it through the lens of successive occupations. The occupation, or at least the oppressive hand of Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. So if you read the Bible and you discount that constant exposure to a heavy hand for 2,000 years, you're probably not going to get everything out of those texts. So what do you say for the Lord in times of occupation, times of political conflict and confusion? Then he pushes them in this strange direction. and Samaria. Which, of course, is where nobody wants to go, because we all have one. It becomes a question of who is our Samaria? Who are those people for us? And whoever they are, we never want to go. That's exactly where we're being sent. There is no ministry on the part of the children of God that doesn't take them to their own scorned places. Prisons, teenage pregnancy, interfaith dialogues. You know, people who hold very different theological views that we are quick to marginalize and become. That's our scenarios, you know, among others. And then to the ends of the earth, sort of global, God is a sovereign being. I think that the task of a pastor is to navigate all four areas. So the congregation over time is living into a bigger, broader vision of what it means to be a Christian than simply what it means to be a Baptist, what it means to be a Methodist, what it means to be a member of a particular church. We have over time, I think, reduced the message of the gospel to a set of formulas that ask very little from us and get very little out of us. And I think there are times, one of your former Princeton colleagues, Cleophas LaRue, wrote a book about the heart of black preaching. And in that book, LaRue says, well, black preachers have historically operated out of five spheres. The first one he calls a priestly function. There are times for that. The second he calls care of the soul, which is, you know, times of death and funerals and so forth. I'll skip the third. The fourth is what he calls matters of common community concern. What's happening not in your church, but within your own ethnic group. So for him, that's issues of black male high school dropout rates or black female teenage pregnancy rates. And, you know, what do we living in that community say about those things? The fifth one he calls the maintenance of the institutional church. How do you pay the bills, keep the lights on? In the middle, between the first two and the second two, he talks about and social concerns. Now, he doesn't suggest, nor do I, that every Sunday you ought to be in Jeremiah. Bear in mind what happened to Jeremiah. So don't do that to yourself every Sunday. But I'll tell you, these days, with the present public dialogue, the church just cannot be silent on the conversations that are rampant in our country and in our world. And I think we do our congregations a disservice if when they come to church and they've come from a week of this bombardment, nothing we say helps them think more clearly about what does it mean to be a Christian in a world like that. So I agree, we need priests, and some folks are that primarily. But every now and then there ought to be a little righteous indignation that you just can't keep. And again, if it is a matter of convenience, I just don't want to make anybody unhappy. Well, there's some verses on that too.
Another question. Dr. Ben.
I was wondering how you saw the role of a religious education in light of what you said about the church. Do we as educators in a religious institution have a different or an extended role or have a different vantage point that might be helpful in all of this?
Yeah, I think particularly in a liberal arts sense, that students are well served if they can leave here with a clearer view of the world that awaits them, of the varieties of places, practices, cultures, of course languages, religions, national histories. I think everything I'm trying to refer to here comes out of a sense of a worldview that tries really hard to not be xenophobic. I think we have to help Americans understand that God is not one of us. God's favorite hymn is not God Bless America. God's favorite hymn is he's got the whole world in his hands. And if we can think more about that, then we can look at our own nation and at other nations in a broader sphere than the assumption that somehow we are, because if we are, God help us, we are God's favorite nation. Who said that? Some 19th century church historian who's talking about, you know, the need to go from the Atlantic to the Pacific, God's chosen people, the New Jerusalem, the city on the hill. All of these things are wonderful political comments. God didn't call us to be of any more value to God's agenda than folks in Cuba, or the Congo, or the Ukraine. And to the extent that I can name those places and students can come out of this school and have absolutely no idea where those places are or what the issues going on in those places are, they will be ill-equipped to function as citizens and as civic participants in an ever more complex world. And I think you've got a really wonderful opportunity to plant some seeds that can bear fruit for the next 40 years.
Dr. McNichol, term prophetic seems to be a widely used term in academia and religious academia. I'd like to hear from you in kind of a succinct way what your definition of prophetic is.
Prophetic, I think, has less to do with the text from which you were speaking and more to do with the themes and the topics about which you are speaking. So let's start with the ever-recurring emphasis that the prophets of the 8th, 7th, and 6th century said to their own kings about what their job should have been and what Israel's role should have been about the widows and the orphans and the strangers and the least empowered and the most vulnerable, and the tension that many religionists establish between religious practices. In other words, I'm faithful in the way I observe communion, or I have rigid views about who can be ordained, or there are certain formulas for prayer, but I'm not all that interested in Matthew 25, 31 through 44. So I think that what the prophetic person does, and this is sort of a quote that I'm lifting now from a book on Preaching from the Prophets by James and Christine Ward, which if you haven't seen it, I would urge you to take a look at that. And they say that every now and then, pastors need to preach sermons that lift their congregations beyond their preoccupation with what is happening right in front of them and give them a sense of the broader concerns that are clearly expressed in the gospel, but which we can very easily walk away from because we get caught up with doctrines and dogmas and practices, which I don't think will be the basis upon which, when we face the Lord on the last day, we're going to be examined. I was hungry. I don't care what vestment you wore when I was hungry. I was hungry. I was thirsty. I don't care what hymn book you sang from. I was thirsty. I was naked. I was sick. Here's one we got to keep in mind in the 21st century. Jesus explicitly points back to the Old Testament focus on the care of the stranger, the migrant, the foreigner. And I was in prison. And you did what? Oh, well, if we had known it was you or somebody important, if we had known that it was you, we would have done differently. Well, that's the whole point. Don't do it because it's me. Do it because it's the right thing to do. Because these little ones are how I'm going to judge you. Not how you treat the rich and powerful. How you treat the most vulnerable. So I think what a prophetic preacher tries to do is not pick a prophetic text, but to pick a prophetic theme and find the ways in which that theme is or is not being employed by the church. Even if you lose, I remind you now that the 8th, 7th, and 6th century prophets all failed if their objective was to prevent their predictions of destruction from coming true. So Amos and Micah and Hosea and the first Isaiah spent 25 years trying to turn Israel from certain things, which if they did, God might withhold the judgment. But three transgressions and four, I will do so and so and so and so. And the Assyrians still conquered. And then Jeremiah and Ezekiel and others spent another 25 years trying to forestall the destruction that finally came from Babylon. Those destructions came not because the prophets were silent. They came despite the fact that the prophets were speaking, but the people didn't want to hear it. They were so caught up with the practices and forms of religion, they forgot about the substance. I think the same thing is happening today. We are just preoccupied with being religious. We're completely disengaged from being even a little caught up in righteous indignation. James Baldwin, famous African-American poet and essayist, says, if you are African-American and conscious and not in a state of rage, there is something wrong with you. Well, see, the first thing is that he's saying, are you paying attention? And if you are, and what you see doesn't put you in a state of rage, there's something really wrong with you. If you can be an American in the 21st century, in this presidential cycle, and be unmoved on either side, and don't find something in Scripture that says, gosh, from the perspective of everything I believe, this is just nuts. I don't know what else needs to happen. So that's what I think it is. I think it has nothing at all to do with preaching from Jeremiah. It's preaching like Jeremiah. I would love to have heard his voice. Plaintive voice. Angry voice. I would love to have heard him with Hananiah. I would love to have heard Amos answer Amaziah, who said, go preach this mess someplace else. This is the king's temple. Think about that. This is the king's. This is where the king comes to pray. Don't bring God to the king's temple. And he says, oh, no, I'm not a prophet or a prophet's son. I was busy taking care of sheep and figging more trees, but the Lord said. And I think sooner or later, the Lord just wants to get a hold of some people and send them to say some things that they might otherwise never have said. And the excuse is, well, I didn't plan to say this, but the Lord told me to say it. My advice is don't rush to be a prophet. Risky business. But don't be afraid if your turn comes. We need that kind of voice.
I want to thank Dr. McMichael for his time. If you just join with me with one more round of applause.